Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher. I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. So on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies and blueprints. I talk about some big ideas, but also some of the smaller little tweaks that we can do. I interview experts, I tell stories, I share some of my big epic fails that I've made along the way, because ultimately I believe that teachers play a vital role in helping students reach their creative potential. And before we get started, I want to tell you this is part of a three-part series on empowering students to own the assessment process. If you're interested in taking a deeper dive into this topic, I actually have a self-paced course, so you can watch it anytime, anywhere. You could get the course now and do the course over the course of the summer. I use the word course a lot right there. Of course I did. And it is fully self-paced. It's kind of pajama PD, right? You can sit there in your jammies and learn all about what it means to design authentic assessment that empowers students in self-assessment and peer assessment, how to give better feedback along the way. It is a five-part self-paced professional development course. And again, if you're interested in it, check on the link that's connected to the show notes here and the blog post. And I would love for you to check it out. It's 50% off right now, so it might be something that you're into. All right, let's get started on this idea of the five reasons students should own the assessment process. Now, for years, I viewed very much a teacher-centered view of assessment. I would grade student work and use that to modify lessons and pull small groups. Students would receive a grade, which would then motivate them to work harder. That was my main view. Later, I started realizing that my feedback could actually help students determine what they knew, what they didn't know, and what they needed to do next. Here, assessment began to shift for me from a teacher task to more of a conversation between me as the teacher and students. However, it still remained largely one-sided. Until I started implementing self-assessments and peer assessments on a regular basis. Now, I gotta tell you, I was skeptical at first. I thought students would cheat, or at a minimum, that they wouldn't take the process very seriously. I wasn't sure that peer assessment feedback would be all that accurate. And I really wasn't sure that students on that self-assessment level would be able to figure out what they know and what they don't know and really what to do next. To my surprise, though, students took this process seriously. They provided practical peer feedback and engaged in honest self-reflection. There were some growing pains, a topic that I'll be exploring in the next couple of weeks, but the key word here is growing. I watch my students grow in their self-awareness and metacognition. I watch them grow into more self-directed learners. And meanwhile, this student ownership freed me up as an educator to provide better, more individualized feedback through student conferencing. Today, we're going to talk about this big idea of the five reasons students should own the assessment process. So this is all about empowering students to own the assessment process. And I want us to think about assessment from a broader lens than just taking tests. It's not always something that you give or take. It's something that you do. See, assessment is all around us. If you're a skater at a skate park, you're engaging in self-assessment every time you reflect on your progress and plan your next steps. If you're a runner training for a marathon, you look at time splits and compare it to your goals. If you're a musician, you're engaging in assessment every time you listen to yourself play and make modifications to your approach. As an author, you engage in self-assessment when you revise your work. And it's not always individual. Often assessment happens within the confines of community. If you're a chef, you're engaging in peer assessment when you ask a trusted fellow chef, how does this taste? If you're an artist, you might ask for an extra set of eyes on a particular project. If you're an engineer, you might observe users to see if your design is actually working. If you do any kind of creative work, both self-assessment and peer assessment are vital for improving your craft. It helps you refine your process and it helps you improve your products. Assessment helps us figure out what we know and what we don't know and what we need to do next. But what does this mean for the classroom? Well, it starts with self-assessment. Here, students engage in goal setting where they set goals, plan their approach, and track their progress. They might also engage in self-reflection. So here they can reflect on their learning process, but also they can learn how to focus on their strengths and weaknesses of their products, which then leads to new iterations. So again, they can self-reflect on their process, but also the products. A similar option is a student survey with multiple choices, checkboxes, Likert scales. We're going to be getting into all of this next week when we focus on self-assessment. In some cases, they might have a self-assessment rubric. You get the idea. But it's also what happens when they engage in peer assessment. So a 20-minute peer feedback process, the process of doing something like asking clarifying questions and getting feedback. It could be something like the 3-2-1 structures of 3 strengths, 2 weaknesses, 1 question. It could be something like a mastermind group, or we're again going to be getting into all these different processes of peer assessment as well. So just a heads up, next week we're going to talk about self-assessment. The week after we're going to talk about peer assessment. But the point is simply this: when students engage in self-reflection and self-assessment, they're more aware of their learning. But there are pieces that they don't need, know, and feedback that they also need. And that's where that peer assessment comes in. And when both of those things are happening on a regular basis, students are more empowered to own the assessment process. So let's talk about the 5 reasons now, right? So that's the whole idea of, again, of just giving you a little taste of the self-assessment and peer assessment. But let's really take a deep dive into this notion of why. What do they get out of that? So number one, self-assessment and peer assessment save time. Now, this might seem weird that I'm starting out by focusing on how empowered assessment helps you as a teacher, but I really think that the better off you are, the better off your students are. Let me explain. In my first 2 years in the classroom, I spent somewhere between 15 to 20 hours a day grading, grading papers. And that was a lot. Sometimes I used a rubric. Other times I focused on qualitative feedback. Often I used both approaches together. And while it was exhausting, it always felt like I wasn't doing enough. Students didn't use the feedback I gave them to improve their work. They didn't seem to understand whether they had mastered the standards or accomplished the objectives. And I was working tirelessly, but my students didn't seem to actually use the feedback. When I shifted toward empowering students to own the assessment process, I asked the question, what am I doing for students that they could be doing for themselves? And really, assessment was a big part of this. So I began implementing 1 to 3 self-assessments per week. Some of these were simply self-graded quizzes or short reflections. Others were surveys or rubrics. And by the end of the quarter, I launched our first student portfolio project. In the next semester, I began implementing peer feedback protocols for each lesson. Some of these were short 1 to 3 minute turn-in talks. Others were longer, like the 20-minute peer feedback system or even the mastermind structure, which we're, again, going to be getting into in a couple of weeks. And you know, I soon felt a difference in my schedule. I felt less exhausted and began to experience more rest and even restoration. I spent fewer hours per week assessing student work, but I still had all the data I needed to modify instruction and plan lessons and pull small groups. Meanwhile, I had more time to plan lessons, gather materials, and conference with students, do things like that. Because I didn't have to carry the entire assessment load myself, I was able to offer more frequent, targeted feedback during lessons and then provide less frequent, longer feedback when I filled out project rubrics at the end of a unit. Honestly, assessment became fun. I know that's an odd word for it, but once assessment was no longer frantic and I no longer felt like I was always behind, I could really enjoy providing meaningful feedback. And this all had an immediate benefit to my students. I was more energetic and less stressed out. I could spend more time providing authentic feedback and less time grading papers. Something else began to occur, though. I noticed that my students started to actually use the feedback to improve their work. Because it was fully formative, they were less focused on the grade and instead focused on actually learning and asking themselves, am I learning this and to what level have I actually learned it? And that's when I began to realize the second benefit of students owning the assessment process, which is this, number two. Feedback is more practical when students own the process. As teachers, we have a finite amount of time and energy. No matter how hard we work, we cannot grade every paper or provide meaningful feedback on every single assignment. We cannot always correct every mistake when students practice a skill. We can't clarify every misconception when students study big ideas and concepts. And yet, we know that the best feedback is often timely and practical and relevant. So what do? Well, when students engage in self-assessment, the feedback is immediate. There's not a one-week delay between turning in an assignment and receiving feedback. Furthermore, students can focus on key areas of growth where they want to examine their progress and come up with their next steps. This makes the feedback feel more relevant and practical. Similarly, when students engage in peer assessment, they get the same kind of immediate feedback. Now, this doesn't mean that teacher feedback is irrelevant or untimely. As an educator, you are both a content expert and a pedagogical expert. Students need your feedback in order to improve their skills and their conceptual development. There's actually a danger in using only self-assessment because students might not know what they don't know or what steps they need to take to improve. Similarly, peer feedback can backfire if it's too vague or if it's overly positive or if it's inaccurate. So I want to be clear, as a teacher, you still need to design the systems that help students navigate meaningful self-assessment. And of course, how to give authentic, meaningful peer assessment. We're going to be exploring what that looks like in the next coming weeks. But the point is simply this. When it is done well, students can use the feedback that they're getting in self-assessment and in peer assessment. And when this happens, they have a better sense of what they know and what they don't know, which leads to point number three, students improve in their metacognition. People debate about which subjects will prepare kids for the future, whether it's, you know, engineering or coding or philosophy. The truth is we can't always predict what knowledge students will need in the future. Our students will need to navigate an ever-changing, complicated world. Now, the scary thing is that the rules are constantly changing, but the exciting thing is that our students will be the ones who get to rewrite those rules. I love the way AJ Giuliani puts it. Our job as teachers is not to prepare students for something. Our job is to help kids learn to prepare themselves for anything. In other words, they will need to be adaptable and resilient. They need to be self-directed, meaning they can be self-starters and self-managers. Now, this is why metacognition is so important. When students have strong metacognition skills, they are able to anticipate change and navigate complexity. But that doesn't always happen. According to a Pasquarella and Terenzini study, one of the most significant challenges college students face is managing their own learning. But this goes beyond college and career. If we want students to become lifelong learners, they need to know how to own their learning. They need to be self-starters and self-managers, which means they need to know how to think about thinking. I love the way the authors of How Learning Works put it. They say, to become self-directed learners, students must learn to assess the demands of the task, evaluate their knowledge and skills, plan their approach, monitor their progress, and adjust their strategies as needed. Now, they formulate it as a cycle, a metacognition cycle, and there's a sketch video I created that explains it, but that's the whole idea. We want to empower them to be able to plan their next steps, to be able to assess their strengths and weaknesses, to be able to figure out what they're doing. This cycle can happen rapidly or over a short stretch of, a longer stretch of time. It doesn't have to be sequential, right? So sometimes, although it's often in a cycle, they might jump from one thing to the next. But again, if you think about this cycle, it basically starts with the ability to assess the task at hand. Here, students have a clear picture of what they need to accomplish. In the second phase, students evaluate their strengths and weaknesses. So they look at the task, now they say, here's what I know, here's what I don't know, or here are my strengths, here are my weaknesses. And then they begin to plan out their approach. This is where they're able to look at what needs to be done and say, I'm gonna try this approach. And again, there's this planning phase ahead of time. Sometimes it's a minute, sometimes it's 20 seconds, sometimes the planning takes a whole class period. Then they begin to take action and they apply the strategies. And as they do that, they monitor their progress, which leads to the next phase where they reflect on their learning and adjust their approach. All right. And then that leads back to the initial part of looking at the new task at hand, their new strengths and weaknesses, and it becomes this ongoing cycle. That's why I think it's critical that students own the assessment process. In other words, when they own the assessment, when they're engaging in that self-reflection and that peer assessment, they're able to figure out what they know already, that's their prior knowledge, what they don't know, that's their areas of improvement, what they want to master, that's their goals, and what they will do to improve, that's their action plan. By integrating small self-assessments where students get immediate feedback, they can move quickly through their cycle of metacognition. Similarly, when students gain practical peer feedback, they have a more accurate view of what they know and what they don't know, and that helps them with that metacognition cycle as well. Number four, increased buy-in leads to better engagement. When students own the assessment process, they have a greater sense of buy-in. There's a sense of control or personal agency in their learning. Students grow more aware in their progress as they navigate this learning. They're more aware of what they know and what they need to know. And you can sort of think about this as a continuum of student agency from teacher-centered from the left-hand side to more student-centered on the right-hand side. So I want you to visualize this. And you start with compliance. I'm doing this because I have to. That's very teacher-centered. Engagement is I'm doing this because I want to do this. That's kind of in the middle where it's still more student-centered, but it's still very teacher-directed. And then empowerment, where there's a true sense of buy-in. I'm doing this out of a sense of ownership and buy-in. And when we have students engage in that self-assessment and that peer assessment, they often end up in those two places of engagement and empowerment. And then in general, student engagement is higher. You can also think of student engagement through the lens of Schlechte's levels of engagement. He has two areas. One is focus, the other is commitment. How focused are students on the learning? How committed are they? And a lot of students are in a place of strategic compliance where they are focused in class, but they're not truly committed to the task at hand. They're being compliant as learners, not truly engaged. But if a student is actively assessing their own learning, they are not only focused, but also committed to the learning, right? Because there's a higher level of commitment when you own the assessment process. This increased commitment is what shifts learning from that strategic compliance, which looks like engagement, but isn't truly engagement, to that place of true, authentic engagement. And when that happens, students begin to develop vital lifelong skills, which is fifth idea. Students develop vital lifelong skills. Earlier, I mentioned that we don't always know what knowledge students will need in the future, right? We don't know if they're going to need coding, for example. Some experts say that learning how to code is critical for the future, and it's a new form of literacy, and every student's going to need to be, a coder, and coders will shape the future. Others believe that AI and machine learning will replace coders within the next few decades, and that we're basically preparing students for jobs that will no longer exist. As someone who has taught coding, I see it as a valuable skill, but not because it prepares students to be programmers. Instead, coding teaches logic and syntax and systems thinking. In certain respects, the students will learn many of the same skills by playing chess, right? Even if they're not going to be chess masters, they learn logic and systems thinking and how to be dynamic in decision making. In other ways, coding can be a little bit like sketching a floor plan, and still in other ways, it's similar to learning a new language. Students might not need to learn a particular programming language, but I really think all students can benefit from learning how to code. In other words, in the future, our students will not need more of a particular set of content skills. They'll need transferable essential skills that they can use in any context. This is something Google learned years ago. They did Project Oxygen, and they found, you know, what skills made someone a valuable, successful employee for Google. And they assumed the best predictor of employee success would be the university program, the grades that they got, their STEM expertise. But what they found is that the best employees were the following: being a good coach, communicating and listening well, possessing insights into others, having empathy toward and being supportive of one's colleagues. In other words, the most critical factors involved success in collaboration. So at that point, they did Project Aristotle, they studied groups, and they found that the best groups exhibited equality, generosity, curiosity toward the ideas of your teammates, empathy, and emotional intelligence. Now, some people would call these soft skills, but I hate that term. There's nothing soft about communication, collaboration, or creativity. Others call these 21st century skills, but again, I say these are timeless skills. Yes, we needed them in, you know, this current century, but we're going to need them in the next century, and we needed them in the last two centuries. We have always needed these skills. So what does this leave us with? It leaves us with this idea that there are these vital skills that students need in the future. And I would argue that the best way to prepare students for the future is by empowering them in the present. When students own the assessment process, they grow in self-awareness and intellectual humility. They learn how to engage in goal setting, how to monitor their progress, and if it's embedded in PBL, they learn project management. As students assess their strengths and weaknesses and try new approaches, they grow more resilient. They engage in iterative thinking and often come up with novel approaches for problem solving. And when they engage in peer assessment, they learn how to be a good coach. They learn how to communicate, how to give meaningful feedback. And again, these become those vital collaborative skills as well. So I would argue that if we are empowering students to own the assessment process, then we are empowering them for a life of lifelong learning. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you tell somebody about it? And would you consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcast? Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.